Welcome to Business Trip, a podcast exploring the future of mental health and wellness. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. We're partners at PsyMed Ventures, a fund investing in psychedelic medicine and mental health. Today on the show, we have Alex Morgan, an investor at Khosla Ventures. Alex is one of the most active VCs in neurotech, so we thought he'd be the perfect person to give an overview of this category of startups and its application to mental health. Alex has invested in neurotech companies that help with sleep, to treat depression, and even to enable patients with movement disorders to restore their motor functions. He's an MD, PhD, physicist, and has been at Khosla Ventures since 2015. In this episode, we discuss when neurotech solutions make more sense than old-fashioned drugs, and we ask Alex what neurotechnologies he's most excited about. We also talk about business strategy, including when it makes sense for a company to go the consumer route versus the clinical pathway, as well as what he looks for in neurotech founders. Let's get to it.
Alex, welcome to Business Trip. I want to start with a quite specific question. In the context of mental health or psychiatry, what's the case for neurotechnology and neurostimulation, even more particularly?
Obviously, mental health encompasses many, many things, all the way through conditions that we might think of as core to mental health or common conditions, things like depression, anxiety disorders of various kinds. But of course, addiction is an issue and can be classed in that category. There are things related to even general wellness that could be included. So for example, appetite suppression as it relates to metabolic health, I might even consider within scope. And there's an element where stimulation and devices that provide some sort of change to the physiology of the brain also sort of run a gamut, and diagnostic technologies also play a role. So the SAINT study from Stanford, which looked at how MRI could inform better use of transcranial magnetic stimulation as a way of adding energy to the electrical network as the next words of the brain to achieve therapeutic benefit, showed that by using MRI as a diagnostic modality to map how to use that technology, to use that energy, you could get better outcomes. I think there's a lot of opportunity. We're just starting to scratch the surface. One of the companies that we're involved with, I think that is interesting to a lot of people these days because it moves into brain-computer interface, is Synchron. They are a implanted device that goes in the vasculature of the brain, the cerebrovascular system, and interacts there. Right now, they're using that for measurement of brain activity to enable people with severe movement disorders to interact with, control a mouse, control their iPad, etc. I actually think the future of that technology may also be closed loop, where you measure in one region, stimulate in another. And of course, that may have broad implications for a number of things in mental health. And because it's a relatively minimally invasive technology like a stent, the ability to scale that, we think, could end up being reasonably scalable to approach. So, you know, right now, we're like, well, there's actually, in my mind, lots of ways to approach this. And in you take the general sense, technology that is monitoring brain activity is moving faster paced, and we can even get to things like phenotypic elements. So I try to take a very broad view because sometimes the most interesting approaches are kind of at the edges of a field where different technology comes in and impacts field. And that's the history of all innovations. It comes through that sort of interface. So if you talk about how devices that apply energy, electrical, magnetic, can improve mental behavioral health, I think there's lots of ways.
Got it. So number one, I always find fascinating when people say energy, because the word energy in the context of mental health, some people call it woo-woo, but it's also interesting that this is energy. Ultimately, so much of neurostimulation is delivering different sorts of energy, and we'll get there. I want to double click on the idea of pharmacological interventions. And so we have anything from SSRIs to atypical antidepressants. Why aren't pharmacological interventions enough? What is better about delivering mechanical energy ultimately?
Well, it's not that one is necessarily better, and one does not have to be used to the exclusion of another. right? The brain is a very complicated system. It's not great to use analogies to reason by analogy, but it can be helpful for sort of communication. And I think it might be helpful to look at the history of how we've approached cardiovascular health. The heart is a complicated system. Now, in due deference to all cardiologists, I think most people would think of the brain as being much more complex. We don't approach the heart with just one technology. We have a range of pharmacotherapy devices, procedures to improve people's cardiovascular health. And if we look historically, about the last 50 years has been really transformative in cardiovascular health. And it was not one thing. It was multiple different innovations, endeavors, all kinds of people working, and technology not necessarily related to cardiology coming in and improving how we deal with things like heart failure, heart attack, even our understanding of disease. Just about all around the same time in the 60s, in the early 70s, Framingham study started to tell us what cholesterol was and how it was actually a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, which then led to statins, one of the largest therapeutic categories ever. Christy Barnard started us on the path of heart transplants and really advanced that field, but Fogarty invented the Fogarty catheter, and that created the whole field of interventional cardiology, minimally invasive approaches. We've implanted pacemakers, LVADs, which are basically mechanical heart assisted devices. Just the field has really transformed both with devices, diagnostics, echocardiogram. Cardiac MRI is now supplanting it in some areas. So we have just advanced the field through many modalities. And I think the same is true. And I think we're in now the period where neuroscience is going to have a similar revolution, where basic science in neuroscience and neurology is really opening up a lot of understanding. But at the same time, ancillary technologies are accelerating that. So for example, we have a company, Ultima, that's sequencing technology. They're now starting to push down the cost of sequencing again. It had stalled for a while, and now it's dramatically being reduced. Great. That makes it much more easy for many researchers, not easier, let's say accessible at a lower price point, to do much more high density sequencing. And sequencing is a little bit like a jackknife in biology. You can use a lot of things with sequencing. You can use proteomics, epigenetics, all these other kinds of things. But like now many researchers will be able to do high throughput, high density single cell attack seq, for example. And that's you can learn a lot about what's going on in the level of cellular activities, epigenetic programming, what's happening in the level of individual neurons and glial cells. Over the next few years, we're going to see a lot of that, those insights coming, because the cost of entry, the ability to do that kind of research is coming down through basically a different field. At the same time, things like the ubiquity of mobile devices enables a certain kind of biomarker for mental and behavioral health. Electronic digital clinical trials, which are essential, right? Not if we're trying to understand clinical elements. Cell and tissue engineering is coming apace, and so we're improving the models. So I think there's just a lot of innovation on all fronts that's lifting the whole field. And my hope is, like cardiology, we will see many technologies. Now, again, I'm giving a long answer to a simple question. It doesn't have to be one drug. It's also just how we might use a drug in a better way. Then at the end of the day, we all have brains, and we're all going to, just like in cardiology, as we understand more and more about the pathophysiology of different processes, we'll all at some point benefit. If at the very least, we're all on a path with age, with unfortunately calcification and shrinkage of our brains. And there are all, I think, also a lot of opportunities as we look into the future of neurocognitive decline and age-related diseases of the brain that these technologies may improve. There's indication, actually, you asked about neurotech.
In addition to what you just shared, I think the reality is that different approaches may work for different people, and different people may have preference for different approaches, right? So there's a lot of heterogeneity in this world.
No, I think that's a really underappreciated element, that every individual has a different biology, right? For all that personalized medicine is a little bit of a contemporary thing, medicine has always been personalized, and we have to tailor therapy to an individual person. At the very least, if it's something that doesn't fit in with their lifestyle or their culture or whatever reason, they're not going to use that therapy. So they may not be able to receive benefit. It's not about the optimal therapy in the global sense. It's the best therapy for an individual. And also, individuals have different goals, right? There are certain things where you may end up tuning a therapy where there are some side effects or some elements that you don't like, but you're tuning the level of therapeutic benefit. And there's always context for anything. And that may change even as a function of time, lifestyle, what you need in a work environment as opposed to social situation might be quite different.
In that context, the companies developing better therapeutics or treatments or modalities are extremely valuable. And also companies that are helping physicians understand which treatment to which person at what time and how to combine those treatments is extremely valuable. And we haven't seen enough companies. We're not seeing enough companies being created that are thinking about that.
This is an area that I think about a lot, and it's an area of interest for us for sure. So we have a company down in LA, Kernel. I think COVID made many more people maybe than before familiar with pulse oximetry, the little thing that you put on your finger that has some red lights that tells you the level of blood oxygen, how much oxygen is on your hemoglobin. Well, that is because the body is actually translucent to red and infrared light. But it's a bit like frosted glass, maybe glass that you might have in a bathroom window. It's the light gets scattered. By using technology, much of which comes from things like sensing modalities for autonomous vehicles, you're able to reconstruct the path that light took and actually end up with almost a geographic representation of the ratio of how much oxygen is basically loaded onto hemoglobin and measure that in real time. So dynamic time change. And what that gives you is if you can imagine you have a map of the brain, and at any one instant, you can measure how much oxygen is being used in any portion of that, you actually get a way of measuring brain activity, because as the brain is highly metabolically active, that can shift a little bit. And there's fMRI is based on this type of principle, but you can also measure it with basically light if you have the right technology, which Kernel does. And they are able to look at functional brain maps and how the brain is reacting to various stimulus. And one of the things that they're working on are things like pain biomarkers, whether or not you can predict how people respond to different drugs, helping segment people for clinical trials. And I think that's an example of enabling technology to advance a lot of therapeutics. And some of it may be drugs. It may be transcranial electric stimulation. They can decide if you're likely to respond to a particular flavor of that, or if you're likely to respond to a different drug, or maybe a drug that's being developed and we understand better how to use that drug. The history, unfortunately, of drugs in the space has often been one of a lot of missteps, unfortunately, but that's the whole point. The science-driven medicine improves as a function of time. But a lot of my job is thinking about how can we accelerate those timelines, both to understand what works and what doesn't work. One of the challenges in therapeutics development is always, what is the clinical trial like? And in things like mental and behavioral health, clinical trials can be hard because the endpoints can be squishy. The endpoints, which are a little vague, means you need very large sample size. That makes it very expensive. So if we can compress that, that means that we can figure out what drugs work in which people, in which context, faster and more cheaply, which could be a game changer.
Change is the only constant. So can you provide an overview of the different neurotech techniques that you are most excited about?
I'm excited about all of them. I try not to rule out any particular path being potentially valuable for something. It's often a matter of, is this technology good for something, and trying to find out what that is. And then whether or not we invest in a company is often a question of a lot of other ancillary things about financing and all these other things. As I mentioned, I'm interested in these technologies that use light. It's called FNIRs, functional infrared. MRI continues to be interesting. I am interested in, as we've kind of alluded to, we have a few different companies that are doing things with various kinds of transcranial electric stimulation. I think that has nice properties, that it is a little bit more portable and accessible than the devices that do transcranial magnetic stimulation, although people are figuring out ways to make those technologies much smaller. There's a technology called MEG, which this is why it's interesting. And when you talk, I'll talk a little bit about energy for a second. So going back for a number of years, of course, a lot of stuff in the history of brain science is the war of sparks and soups, right? Are we taking a focus on this as a system of molecules and drugs and proteins and neurotransmitters and chemicals, or are we taking a view of electrical network and an activity that's embedded in that network? And of course, both things are true. So how you have multiple options on intervening. One is by, again, you said energy has convened lots of different things, but in this case, literally putting energy into the system. And you actually can do that in different ways. You can apply actually ultrasound, which can cause thermal heating and thermal activity, which may have benefit for certain things. You can apply magnetic energy, which then there's a duality between electricity and magnetism. One can affect the other. You can use magnetic energy to create electrical activity, and electrical activity to create electric activity. You can measure the electrical activity, which is what EEG is, but you can also measure magnetic activity. Well, that's what MEG is, and actually that gives you some insights into the electrical activity. And it turns out it has a tremendous number of advantages over EEG in terms of sensitivity and the fact that you don't need to deal with the montages of electrodes, wet electrodes and things like that make EEG sometimes quite hard to reproduce or to scale. So that's an area that I'm excited. We have an interesting company that may not immediately sound like neurotech, but I feel like it's of this flavor. And it's a company down in LA called Bionaut. And they use externally applied electromagnetic fields to drive these tiny little bots into the brain. So you can take a spinal tap needle, introduce them, but basically minimally invasively into the spine. They travel up the cerebral spinal canal. Don't do any damage because, again, your spinal cord is actually bathed in fluid. They travel through that fluid. They travel up into the brain and they can deploy drugs or other things or even do little procedures in a very precise way. And you drive them back out and you retrieve them out of the same spinal needle. And we're looking there into very targeted deployment of drugs or potentially even they could deploy other neurotech devices. So the company's just starting to move into human trials, but they've done a lot of their preliminary work in large animals, and they can very safely deploy and retrieve and also deliver payloads of cells or therapeutics.
Can you define what is a payload for the listeners?
In that case, it could be you could actually put cells. So for example, if you're trying to add cells, potentially stem cells, to someone who's had a stroke or Parkinson's disease that might be able to have therapeutic benefit, that's an area of active research. But just as an example, that would be a payload. You could have what's called an oncolytic virus. So there are viruses that people are using as an area, again, an active area of research to treat certain kinds of cancer. So if you had, for example, glioblastoma, you might try to deploy in a very focused way with this type of technology, a virus that's trying to target that cancer, or a gene therapy.
I like how for outer space, payload is one thing. For inner space, payload is another thing.
Although it's similar. In some ways, this is just like a little space capsule that has a payload that you deploy. It's just micro as opposed to macro. And we even have companies doing stuff in aerospace that might have some relevance here. So we have a company, Varda, which is doing manufacturing outside of the gravity well. One of their areas of interest is in things, can they make certain kinds of therapeutics that may be very hard to synthesize chemically in the gravity? So in free fall, there are certain processes, things like certain kinds of crystallizations that may lead to new cures. So there's another kind of payload.
Totally.
Super interesting. What's your framework when assessing whether a neurotech company should pursue the clinical route versus a consumer go-to-market?
So this is hard and it's very context dependent. It is sometimes also dependent on the team, frankly, in that some teams may be better able to execute on one than another. In general, I would say in my business, we're in the business of exceptions, right? So many of the most interesting companies succeed by doing something that everyone else thought was impossible. So I want to caveat anything that I say with actually just because I say this, maybe we've seen this is challenging or difficult. It doesn't mean it's impossible. But in general, in the US, is more true in Western Europe, it is incredibly difficult to get significant out-of-pocket spend for many types of clinical indications. Certainly, the kinds that often are more successful are in cosmetic indications more than they are in other areas. Now, that's a broad generalization. And I also would say that companies don't necessarily need to do one or the other exclusively. There may be versions of the product that are appropriate for one element. There may be goals that they try to, for example, data collection may be a reason to go early into a more consumer-oriented market positioning. Sometimes it's natural. It would be very hard for Synchron to be a DTC company, for example. Other companies, it's less clear. It's not always one or the other. And a lot of times it's also questions like capital allocation, speed. In general, our goal is to find another, for people that are scientists, like the way I like to look at it is we try to reject hypotheses as quickly and cheaply as possible, which means let's try something. If that's not the right thing, try something else and try to do that quickly and in a capital efficient way, address most of the risk. And sometimes the question when certain markets is their attention, is their willingness to pay, all these other things. And they don't have to be the forever answer either.
So in this, it doesn't need to be an either or. A clear example is a company that first goes direct to patient, direct to consumer. They test out their hypothesis. They show some clinical efficacy. And then they go to payers and providers and say, hey, this is working now. Why don't you reimburse it? So that would be a way to maybe fasten or kind of accelerate the path towards ultimately reimbursement. But it's counterintuitive, but you're first going out of pocket.
I'll give an example that is slightly behaviorally related, behavioral health related, although I don't think many people would necessarily think it this way. We have a company called Hello Heart that has a digital, basically cardiovascular health program, particularly focused on blood pressure. And their system is able to dramatically, depending on exactly where you start out, dramatically lower blood pressure in people that join the program. They started as a DTC offering, and that enabled them to focus on actually the design elements of adherence, compliance, however you want to talk about it. But basically, a lot of what they need to do is for that kind of a digital health program, they actually just had to get the design right of the program and show that they could get people to actually want to use it. And in a DTC environment, which is much more competitive in that for on those parameters, they really had to fight it out and figure out their product very quickly in order to get any traction at all. Now, unfortunately, you know, the reality is at scale, there aren't a lot of people that are willing to pay out of pocket for that, but there are a lot of payers if your program is demonstrated to have efficacy, that once you collect a lot of data that your program does reduce blood pressure consistently and effectively, that they have been able to move then into reimbursement and have a great company now that's going, you know, that basically is a reimbursed health benefit. At first, they went into the employee health space. That to me is a great example for that particular company. And we often see that where companies that have to have great consumer engagement and great consumer product need to fight it out to figure out how to get their product at the appropriate quality. Other technology may not exactly have the same trajectory.
Yeah, absolutely. I also like the idea of starting with the patient in mind and the patient journey and experience and optimizing for that, which is usually something that's very criticized about healthcare companies, that they're optimizing for payers, they're maybe optimizing for providers, but no one really thinks about the patient. So that's, in my opinion, the beauty of this bottoms-up approach, so to speak. Going back to more like the business side of it and business models, how do you think of defensibility in the context of a company doing neurotech?
Sure. So obviously defensibility is good. You know, if people listening to this are entrepreneurs, oftentimes venture capitalists ask about it. I would say that there's a lot to unpack there when if you're pitching to a venture capitalist and they ask you about defensibility, take a pause here for as a maybe public service in it to help you think about pitching. Part of it is also just to understand how you think about competition and do you understand what your true competition is? As an example, if you're a company that has a neurotechnology in, let's say, treating depression, your competition is actually every thing that people could use to treat their depression. It's not other neurotech companies per se. It's because at the end of the day, patients or their providers, whoever the decision maker is that decide makes the allocation decision about using that particular product, it's their problem they're addressing. And in general, people are also just asking how you think about competition. Some very successful companies don't have what we would consider a traditional moat. On the other hand, many things in healthcare and biotech are able to get strong patent protection. And that often is a great kind of very defensible moat, depending on how the company positions themselves. And that's why often companies that have an approved drug with patent protection have software-like margins, at least for a while. I would say one of the things that is interesting to me about neurotech is the fact that we are starting to think... So when people talk about digital therapeutics, they often, 99% of the time, are talking about effectively some kind of cognitive behavioral therapy app. And that's not bad. They can be very effective and very popular. But I'm also interested in a generalization of that principle of a digital therapeutic. So for something like a transcranial electric stimulation device, we can think about the drug as actually, I'm going to return to energy. Maybe that'll be the theme for this conversation, is the drug is energy. And that means the drug is actually information. And if the drug is information or the therapeutic is information, in theory, you could have a company that they improve the drug as a function of time because they deploy that in different ways and they improve how they deploy that in different ways to actually increase the benefit of that therapeutic as a function of time. And that to me is really interesting, sustained competitive moat because that's actually not available to most traditional drug-based biotherapeutics. You can't go back to FDA and say, I think I'm going to quickly switch the molecule out with this other one. Let's just slip it in to the approval. That's not how it works. But as we develop digital therapeutics where information is a therapeutic, actually it becomes easier to change and evolve that with time. And these are like the great companies. Google is to me the great example of a company whose product gets better as a function of use, right? In their core product of search, you put in a query, you get back results, you click on the most relevant ones, their product has learned from use. The product gets better as a function of time. Very little in healthcare has that property where the product gets better as a function of time.
This is a question that I'll give you a bit of a challenge on, which is I'd like you to tell me of the following options.
Multiple choice, love it.
Multiple choice. What attribute is most important for a neurotech device for mental health to become successful? A, ease of use, as in the UI, UX. B, the efficacy. 3, time to benefit. D, something else.
This is hard because it, to me, would have to be a little bit more context dependent on the particular use case and how in some of these parameters, because they're all important. I would like to say that long-term, it is efficacy. If that efficacy is sufficient enough. And the reason I would say that is, for example, many things in healthcare, so a lot of design for things in healthcare, it's often a question of how do I do workflow integration or patient journey integration. That is important up to a point. If you are dramatically beneficial, basically work patterns and lifestyle patterns will adapt around you. Your first point about ease is not there, depending on what the therapy or what the intervention is, it's not just patient ease though. It can also be provider ease or ability, you know, and frankly, it's also sometimes a provider ability to monetize. So if there are ways that providers can make money, those have faster uptake. Now, it doesn't mean ultimately that something won't be successful, but it can affect trajectory and all kinds of other things. So all these things are important. There's trade-offs like anything, and time to efficacy can be valuable. But it depends on the indication. And again, people are willing to do a lot. Physical therapy is a great example of something that is actually a pretty long time to efficacy for a lot of people to receive the benefit. So what are we trying to do there? We're trying to make physical therapy easier. And so we have a company, Sword, that is doing at-home physical therapy. They actually increase the amount of physical therapy you do because it's hard to get to physical therapy for some people. If you have a problem, maybe it'd be actually hard to go to physical therapy. That's the whole problem. I feel like a lot of times you ask me questions, it depends. But we're in such a broad space where mental health and behavioral health, and again, it's not just what people traditionally think about mental health, right? Addiction plays a role. Many people's cardiovascular disease is really a function of behaviors. And so if we can improve things on the behavioral side, we may improve other things, right? We may improve kidney function as a side effect, because by improving certain behaviors, we've improved people's cardiometabolic health and their blood pressure, and then their kidneys are better, and suddenly people don't need dialysis. So all these things are connected in very interesting ways.
Such a good segue. Alex, you mentioned this company, Sword Health, and you have Sword Health for MSK. You have, it's not the same, but you have Verta Health for diabetes management and similar companies. I wonder, what is the Sword Health of mental health?
We have a company in the portfolio, Headspace Health, which is in the behavioral health space. We have another called Limbic, which is using AI in mental health. I do think that getting access to care through digital channels and through better optimization into care pathways using AI is definitely a game changer in the space. So the interesting thing is, most people need, even in traditional talk therapy, right? When do people most need that? You might think of your own life, like, when are you at your lowest points? It's often when you're like laying in bed, perseverating, thinking about your day. It's often like 10 p.m. to 2 in the morning. That's really not the way mental behavioral health is delivered in the traditional context, where you go into a doctor's office and talk to the person for 50 minutes once a week, or not doctor, but a, you know, therapist's office, all kinds of different providers. That's maybe not the great, both greatest when you need it. But also, frankly, they have very little insight into your actual life, right? When we did the original investment into Ginger, which evolved and combined and merged with Headspace Health, Ginger was actually a technology for biomarkers in mental and behavioral health on your phone, because your phone knows a lot more about you. It knows, did you leave the house that day? Are you making it to your appointments? Are you needing dopaminergic surge? Are you constantly checking your email or your Facebook or Twitter feed? There are powerful biomarkers. And we're starting to use these insights to engage with people, improve how we apply and treat them through, again, it could be even just different ways of doing talk therapy at the right time.
I think there's a component of some of these digital health companies in more kind of like physical health than mental health that are still not being used in psychiatry. So anything from nutritional support or nutritional analysis to more of physical biomarkers like blood samples or even FNIRS analysis to sleep hygiene or peer support, right? So combining all these things that are traditionally today being used by companies targeting physical health could be used. And my hypothesis is that they would be very effective for the treatment of mental health disorders.
Undoubtedly. There are people, companies, efforts making inroads, whether they're building better biomarkers, companies like Headspace Health, finding better ways of using provider resources, trying to get care to patients when they most need it. And also the other thing is, the mental and behavioral health, of course, are on a spectrum from acute need. There are all the way to everyone needs something at some point. And there was certainly during COVID, various organizations reporting that something like 30% of the population actually qualified as having actually a clinically significant amount, a burden of things like depression or anxiety. And so, you know, it is not a unique set of phenomena. And certainly things like ADHD, can we use these technologies to improve people's ability to study and learn and be more productive at work? Everything's on a spectrum, where certainly these technologies can provide benefit to not only people that might have a DSM-coded thing that they want help on, also just everyone. This is the frame of kind of positive psychology, is that everyone can improve their well-being, their sleep, their interactions, their productivity. And certainly, you know, we're in an age where we're medicalizing more and more of what we do, right? Our chairs have a medical element. Back 100 years ago, food was cultural, or what was accessible, what was in the region that you live. Now it's a medical product in a lot of ways. People think about the nutritional components. We think about our relationships in a medical way sometimes, right? People have interpersonal conflict. You go actually see a therapist. And so we're in a world where we're going to move more and more into medicalization of products and services over time, as both we understand the science of how to improve people's experience with the product or technology or whatever. I mean, we're learning a lot about how, you know, the current digital age is impacting mental well-being, and that'll be an interesting evolution. We'll see how where things end up.
So what's your process of finding new companies? Are you reading research and getting excited about certain technological innovations? Are you receiving inbound pitches? How does it generally work?
Those are two ways. So we do a lot of different things. Sometimes there's research that we lead into, and we often can help academic scientists create companies based around innovation. We certainly get a lot of inbound. We also try to track the space. And if we get interested in a space, we'll do a reach out. I found Synchron through an IP search. So we had done an IP search and found a patent and reached out to them, reached out to Tom Oxley. And he said, well, actually, he was in Melbourne at the time. He said, oh, you know, we found this patent. He looks like you have a company. Do you, want to talk about it? And he said, actually, yeah, I'm going to be in California and I'm raising money. So he came by and we ran a process and ended up investing there. So it can come through lots of different ways. Certainly we get a decent amount of inbound. We just do some outbound. And sometimes we're also just, we actually help create companies from scratch in areas where we can't find a company necessarily, or a piece of science has prompted something.
Are there any kinds of companies that you're looking to fund right now?
In general, so the firm as a whole, we're pretty broad. We invest in fusion and aerospace, and we seed invested in Square so small vendors could avoid credit card transaction fees, fee gouging. We did Impossible Foods as a clean tech investment. So we invest in lots of different areas. They're looking for always creative, driven teams trying to do some positive change in the world. And then we look at them as individual companies. Is this does it make sense to us? The market they're going after, they're trying to do, the ambitious group trying to do something important and big in the world? Do we think they have are they differentiated with capabilities? And these can be all different kinds of capabilities depending on what the company is. It could be very good at consumer product development. It could be very good at electrophysiology. It just depends on what the company is trying to do, what the goals are, what we think the needs are. And then sometimes our job is to try to help them. Say, great, your team is good at all these things. You really need something to help with consumer marketing. So we'll help you hire that.
Mm-hmm. And one other question regarding your sort of process when evaluating companies. What are some quick reasons that you would pass on a neurotech company when reviewing their deck?
Capital efficiency to get to some value-creating milestone is a big one. Lack of differentiation. There's not ever a single thing. So investment decision is very holistic. You're investing in the opportunity at a certain price with a certain team at a certain time with a certain plan in place. And we invest in very, like I said, we do incubation, we do late-stage investment. So companies can have different flavors. I'll give an example of a prototype of a kind of company, not just in neurotech, that I often see. Is a company that's basically along the frame of, if you give me $100 million, I will collect a bunch of data and I will discover something interesting. Now, that may well be the case. On the other hand, it's not necessarily a great use of money to just deploy collecting a whole bunch of data. Often, especially if the data rapidly depreciates in value. So certain kinds of data collection efforts, actually the modality they're using to collect that data is improving. So the technology is improving in that space so that, like, as soon as you finish completing the data, the next group that could come along could do it for $25 million. So does it make sense to do that? Many pitches often boil down to just that. And that's, I typically don't think of that as a great fit if there isn't some other element where it's completely proprietary data, or there's some other angle, or the team is really good, or they understand a positioning of exactly how they'll do something, or they'll create a competitive edge. Whatever that means, a great example, I'll take another example. One of the challenges in healthcare traditionally is that it has sought to scale and to improve through throwing human labor at the problem. And you have a problem, some adverse events happen, we're going to do training, right? We're going to create a new role for that. And that's not a great way to create a scalable solution to a problem, because it's just the overhead, the dissemination of training, for example, is incredibly inefficient. One of the nice things about digital therapeutics and digital systems is, in theory, we could correct things like biases. So let's say you identify a bias that you would like to remove in some element of healthcare. Like, let's say there's a racial bias in how healthcare is being deployed. It can be quite hard to change that, because maybe just inherently many of the people acting in that system have this bias and that's causing the problem. To get change there actually is quite challenging. Let's say you have an AI system, and many AI systems end up with various kinds of biases that, once we identify them, we'd like to remove them. That might be as simple as effectively like a software update and you solve the problem, or as some element of that, we can improve the technology at scale much more efficiently. And then the scaling properties and efficacy, because again, human driven solutions often diminish in quality as a function of scale. Digital solutions often improve in quality as a function of scale. And that's a very different property.
So continuing with the technologies part, I want to maybe play a game, which is talk about technologies that are potentially too early for translation into startup land, but in some way are promising. And the beauty of venture VC many times is that we don't need to have all the data to make bets and invest, because probably, and feel free to disagree, if we have all the data and everything's there, then it's too late. I'll name a few that are exciting for me in a ranking of more ready for translation to less ready. So one that we've been tracking for a while, it's transcranial focused ultrasound. And there's exciting activity in the space. We actually made one investment in a company that's still, it's still stealth, but overall, it just seems very early. The other one that I think about, and you mentioned the AI, is the use of autonomous agents in care delivery for mental health, right? I think that when I see companies that are doing that, I'm not convinced that is doable right now, and potentially quite dangerous. And then one that's even more out there is using stuff like, it's basically the idea that we have capacities to communicate without verbal cues. So some people call it telepathy, right? Or even channeling, right? Communicating with different beings, that we're clearly not there. But I think there's one day something there. So I would love for you to share, what are those technologies or things that one day may become a company?
Yeah. So AI is very interesting to me. I was an AI researcher in what is now probably considered effectively the Paleolithic before contemporary deep learning approaches. But it was, you know, I worked on a lot of things in natural language processing at one time in mining biomedical data. Certainly, I see what Synchron is doing as maybe actually having some of that property, where you have their device in the cerebrovascular system of people. And so there's actually a video you can see of some of the, of a couple ALS patients texting each other with their brain machine interface device. So they're effectively communicating via what you might think of as a system. Now, there it's not reading thought and intention so much as it is interpreting muscular, essentially movement intention, for example, manipulating clicking and mouse movement and things like that. But we're going to get there. I think we're getting there. And there are certainly approaches to measure things like cranial nerves so that you can detect intention for vocalization, right? So if you could monitor the nerve outlets that are controlling things like your mouth and your tongue, and you sub-vocalize, the ability to use also AI language models to sort of help fill in your intention. So part of the, also what we can do is by detecting limited rough signals, just like you can get autocomplete on a mobile device that says, are you trying to say this? You can, in theory, interpret these signals and say, are you trying to say this? Which I think is all, it's all feasible.
So what are your most out there ideas?
Well, superconductivity, room temperature superconductivity would be pretty much a game changer for a lot of technologies and a lot of kinds of electronics, certainly computation, medical imaging, right? Like MEG could be totally game changer for how we measure brain electroactivity. I'm old enough to remember these guys, Fleischmann and Pons, who had the cold fusion stuff in the early 80s that turned out to not reproduce, and there's some other chemistry going on. So I would be cautiously optimistic that we have a room temperature superconductor that is easy to manufacture, but we may. Yeah, it'll be interesting, and that could be game-changing.
Would you say that's game-changing?
As I said, like, you know, the ability to measure electrical activity in the brain, certainly, like MRI would be, essentially, you can think of fMRI-type technology being massively augmented, because what is a lot of the facility around an MRI machine is actually cooling for the magnets and the electricity, because the high powered fields, there's also there's loss of energy, basically MRI type imaging that's measuring proton spin, but also MEG type technology. One of the challenges is actually heat density. So if you have lots of basically very sensitive magnets, high density close to the head, one of the challenges is actually how do you dissipate heat? And if you had very hot room temperature superconductors, easy and cheap to manufacture, you could imagine shrinking all that stuff down, being able to measure electrical activity in the brain in a whole new level and much cheaper. Again, if this is just an example. Certainly various kinds of electronics could be, you know, embedded, implanted devices. Much of the greatest impact in biotech comes actually from physics, because new materials, new modalities, things like ultrasound, MRI itself, the material that you use, even for medical devices, right? That's material science, chemists, engineers in totally different disciplines, unlock a lot of potential.
Yeah. So if you're thinking about starting a company in biotech or in neurotech, become a physicist. I like that. No, but jokes aside, I agree. I know.
I originally did physics as an undergrad, and I actually started grad school in physics before switching to AI, because for a while that seemed like more interesting, and then I ended up in biology and medicine.
Yeah, I mean, understanding the fabric of reality, it's kind of a useful skill. I get it. So that's for sure.
Well, but it's also things like, where does DNA structure come from? That was X-ray crystallography, right? And Francis Crick was a physicist, and then he did that, and then he figured out, you know, what the amino acid code was, right? Pick an innovation. Radiology and imaging has been one of the more transformative things in medicine. And all of those innovations, step by step, have come from insights in basically physics, whether that's from the very early days of radiation, where we got X-rays, through to contemporary techniques.
What goes on in, let's say, non-ordinary states of consciousness? Like, this is coming very much from, let's say, psychedelic journeys, meditative, deeply meditative experiences, where it seems like some of the dynamics aren't quite able to be measured by physics.
Well, there's a bit of a leap there in that almost all the interesting stuff in human brain activity is not measurable right now. And so particular examples such as psychedelic experiences are just one flavor of that, right? So that right now we're in a state where and this is generally true across biology, not just neuroscience. We often have a very good ability to measure many micro scale elements in very finely. So, it's almost like economics in my mind. So we might understand certain elements of economic transactions. We might have to get all this measurement of like what people are paying for mackerel today. And that's, we have tons of data on that. We might have tons of data on how many people are buying certain kinds of widgets, all kinds of things. We can also do behavioral economic experiments and understand how people will act in certain situations with great reproducibility. On the other hand, trying to understand how the economic system of the country and the world actually operates as a complex system. How to set the optimal interest rate, for example, is no one has, as far as I can tell, no one has any idea. And so we might be able to measure the activity and properties of many cells, many receptors. We may be able to measure high-level properties of brain activity. We can do fMRI networks. But, you know, we are very far from even understanding the salience of like, what is the experience of like smelling a flower or seeing, you know, your loved one, let alone trying to unpack, you know, someone's particularly psychedelic journey. So if you said like physics can't explain it, I'm like, yeah, physics can't explain most of what's going on in the brain that we actually are probably interested in. It can explain lots of micro phenomena, but there's a technical definition of a complex system where you can't predict the behavior of the aggregate from any of these micro measurements. And it is a complex system that we're very far from understanding. So it's always dangerous to say that something won't be measured or won't be accomplished, right? You could say like people wouldn't be able to do this and somebody finds a way. That's the beauty of my job, is I often get to hear from people that have found a way to do something or think they found a way to do something that everybody thought was impossible before I heard them.
Absolutely. So we're going to move to a fun section we have, which is the rapid fire.
All right. I haven't been very good at answering concisely, so I'll try to do better now.
What is your strongest suit as an investor?
Ooh, it's a good question. I have probably a stronger, more diverse technical background than many investors I meet. Unfortunately, went to school for a long time, worked in a lot of different areas. As I said, I kind of alluded to, I studied physics, did PhD in basically computational biology and AI applied to biomedicine, worked as an AI researcher, went to medical school, did a postdoctoral fellowship in biochemistry and genomics. So I've worked in lots of different areas. I worked at the Smithsonian Observatory and the Stanford Particle Accelerator and hospitals and all these different things. So I have often a diverse technical background, but actually somewhat deep compared to many other investors who often come either, let's say, from a finance background or maybe product background. So that's a differentiator. And I have a different frame than many people.
What is your weakness as an investor?
It's hard for me to see technologies that do benefit patients, but don't have an effective business model. And that's a hard thing because one of the things about being investors, these companies have to ultimately succeed. And unfortunately, there are things out there, companies that do have technology and products that actually do think benefit people. And they may be stuck in a situation where they're in a business context that doesn't enable them to have a business that will thrive. And that is hard for me.
Fair. What is the case for having biotech and tech under the same fund?
Well, this is my view. So I don't know if you can convince others, but I actually think too much concentration in a particular area is challenging for, an investment vehicle. And the reason I would say that is oftentimes you're trying to invest in new areas that didn't exist or didn't exist in quite this way that you thought when you're sort of consolidating the fund or putting it together. And you want the flexibility to chase those opportunities. You know, oftentimes, if something is mature enough space that you can convince a lot of LPs that it's a hot area, it actually may be the wrong time. You'd be on the wrong side of the hype cycle. That's one way to think about it. Now, the second element is that there are inherently ups and downs in the broader market conditions that even if you're picking the best companies in a particular sector, that sector may just be in a bad situation for totally extrinsic reasons related to later stage companies, right? And so a little bit of diversity, I think, can help you manage your fund and distribute resources and keep going in other areas. So it's not necessarily about particular sector. You know, a lot of times external things can affect fund performance, even if you happen to have great companies. And so you have to keep in mind that you need to balance that.
Yeah. What is your current tech wearable setup?
It varies because I get access to a lot of technology. A lot of times I'm trying things. But right now, the things that I'm getting health read about, mostly the Apple Watch, because I use that for other things during the day, an Oura Ring at night. And then I've been continuing to use StemScience's Somni device right before bed. Or actually, I put it on in bed, listen to some podcasts or audiobooks, and go to bed.
Yeah. I jokingly say that I invest in neurotech so I can get free devices.
Yeah, well, there's that.
My last question is, can you tell us a bit about the books on your bookshelf?
So I have about 6,000 print books. I should start there. And they're in all kinds of different categories. The books that are behind me, there are some books related to digital photography, programming, statistics, computational statistics, things like that. That's why they happen to be most proximal. They're very specifically related to how I use them here, but other sections of my house have, for example, other collections of books in different areas like history, biography, books on biology, medicine, a lot of art books, actually.
Awesome. Well, this was really comprehensive and I learned a lot. Thank you so much, Alex, for joining.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I hope other listeners got what they wanted out of it. And it sounds like your audience is interested in things like entrepreneurship and advancing developments in neurotherapeutics and health and wellness. So anything I can do to help people along that journey, I always want to do. And that's, it's great, even if we're not investors in companies, great to all see, innovation in this space. It's great because people are trying to improve health and well-being. And so even if I'm not involved as a person and potentially a patient or a customer, I'm glad to see those innovations happening.
What I learned today is that you're a Renaissance man from all the things that you studied, physics, you're an MD, PhD, bioinformatics, AI, you just mentioned photography. So truly the definition of a Renaissance man. Super interesting opportunity.
I don't know about that. Maybe I just have a short attention span, perhaps.
It's all semantics.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
This is Business Trip, a podcast exploring the future of mental health and wellness. If you like this episode, you can help us by subscribing to the podcast and leaving a review. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SciMedVentures. And if you're building a company in frontier mental health, hit us up at hi@scimed.ventures, which you can find in the show notes. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Caitlin Nair coordinates our podcast. Production and editorial assistance comes from Jonathan Davis. Sound design and engineering by Nico Ray. Our theme music is by Dorian Love, and additional music credits are in the show notes. Thanks for listening to Business Trip. We'll see you next time.